Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute also offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Internationalizing the University of Utah. And now I'd like to introduce Professor Howard Lehman, Fulbright Scholar Representative, who will be introducing today's moderator.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone for coming. I appreciate it. I think this will be an informative discussion and a unique experience with panelists who are all Fulbrighters. I am the faculty Fulbright representative, so I'll be very glad to talk to you later and other times about the Fulbright program. The university is committed to outreaching to students and to faculty to increase the number of students and faculty who are applying and receiving Fulbright awards, since this is a collaborative effort and part of the university to do that. We will have a networking reception at the end. We'll have some food later delivered here, and so hope you can stick around and talk to me, talk to the panelists, talk to the others who are on this panel. Before I introduce the moderator, I'd like to introduce the others on the panel. First, I'd like to introduce Dr. Michael Hardman. I'm pleased that he's here. He is the Chief Global Officer for the Office for Global Engagement, and he'll talk about the university's continuous plans to internationalize the campus. And we have five panelists here, all who have received the Fulbright Award. We have two faculty scholars, Professor Bruce Smith from the Department of Communications, Sciences, and Disorders. In between here, you have Professor Wesley Sasaki Umua, the Department of History, and we have three students who have all received Fulbright Awards relatively recently, Mercedes Ward, David Prophet, and we have a foreign Fulbright scholar here, student as well, Amir Kabibulin from Russia. And they all will provide interesting, unique experiences about their time as a Fulbrighter. I'm pleased to introduce our moderator for today's forum, Professor Mushtaq Memon. Professor Memon is in the Department of Veterinary Clinical Sciences at Washington State University. He is a Fulbright scholar who spent a year in Oman a few years ago, and he was selected to serve as a Fulbright alumni ambassador, and that's his role here coming from Washington State to moderate this discussion. He's also the founding president of the Eastern Washington North Idaho chapter of the Fulbright Association. So please join me in welcoming our moderator, Dr. Memon.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lehman. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm delighted to see quite a few of you here joining us in some very interesting discussion. And before I start saying anything, I'd just like to acknowledge and thank our Utah chapter of Fulbright Association. You see the banner over there. And Dr. Lehman is very much involved in that association, which covers the whole state of Utah. And then Office of Global Engagement, sponsoring the networking reception, and the Hinckley Institute that we are here in the room, we appreciate their supporting this function here. At the same time, Fulbright Alumni Association and the Fulbright Program, who has sponsored my visit to come here in Pullman to share with you some of my ideas and perspective here. So before we start, I think we have Dr. Hardman on the schedule, and he's going to share with us the vision of the university to internationalize or globalize this institution and what efforts have been taking place and how his office supports his students and faculty.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is terrific. What a great turnout. Wonderful. I do want to begin by saying that the title of my very brief remarks, Internationalizing, I have about 2 hours worth of PowerPoints for that. So we were not going to do that this afternoon because this is really all about the panel and all about Fulbright. But I do want to just, I want to begin by welcoming Dr. Miller and the very distinguished panel who, from the university's perspective, represent the heart and soul of what this university needs to be doing in its work with Fulbright. I also want to acknowledge Howard. Howard has been literally a one-person operation in terms of Fulbright, and that's something that the university, through its new Office for Global Engagement, plans to really provide the resources and support into Howard's work and to expand our efforts through the Office for Global Engagement. And Howard's worked very closely with Sabina Klar, our Deputy Chief Global Officer, and the Office of Global Engagement. So we're very proud to be a sponsor this afternoon. And I do want to just begin by saying the Office for Global Engagement is the first centralized operation within the university to bring together much of the work that is being done around the university in terms of both our academic and our resource support, as well as move forward in initiatives for the future, of which Fulbright is, again, at the heart of who we are and what we do. So in terms of just a quick kind of a vision statement, it is really, the purpose of the office is to strengthen the university, the entire institutional commitment to faculty and student participation. Globally. We want to also establish a much stronger resource base to support faculty and program-driven global research and teaching efforts. We want to facilitate student mobility around the world, and we want to build a very clear organizational structure for global operations, as well as provide state-of-the-art facilities and gateways in various parts of the world. And our first gateway for the University of Utah will open, and we are now recruiting students, and I'm very pleased to say that we're getting some very good responses to our initial recruitment for the University of Utah Asia campus in Incheon, South Korea, in which we're partnering with two other U.S. universities, and a Belgium university, and if all goes well on the political front, St. Petersburg from Russia will join us in 2015. They've already committed to come into this. So this is a big part of who we are. And I think in terms of what I really want to say in my very brief remarks about Fulbright, Fulbright is clearly the U.S. government's flagship international education scholarship fellowship program. And it is an initiative that this is true for whether it's the U.S. Student Scholar Program or whether it's the Faculty Scholar Program or the Fulbright Hayes Doctoral Dissertation Award. Now, yet for us as a university, as amazing as all that of that is about and what we know about Fulbright, it is without question unbelievably underutilized on this campus. And it's something we need to pay a lot of attention to, and we are paying a lot of attention to it. I don't usually like to give, I guess you could refer to as not so great looking statistics for the university, but I think it tells you where we need to start and where we need to go. So just in terms of student Fulbright awards, in 2012, in comparison to our Pac-12 institutions, is which we consistently now compare ourselves to, whether we think that's the peer comparison or not, that's where we're going as a university in terms of comparison. So when you look at student Fulbright awards, we're last in the Pac-12, dead last. We had only one award in 2012-2013 out of five applications submitted. This is in comparison to ASU, 23 student Fulbright grants, 58 applications. UCLA, 15 Fulbright awards, 53 applications. University of Arizona, University of Colorado, University of Oregon, each awarded seven Fulbright student grants last year, and all Pac-12 institutions, other than us and two others, who shall go nameless, average 50 applications per year coming out from students. We average five. Now, the good news is there, of that five, we had a 20% hit rate. So that should tell you that that we did well, at least in the hit rate. But it also tells you that it's not just the fact that we don't have those applications, it's really where's the level of support coming from the university to bring this to the attention of both students and faculty. What are we doing to make this much more aware, make the Fulbright opportunity, the incredible Fulbright opportunity, much more aware for faculty and students? And this is exactly where we want to go, and I look forward to sitting here today and listening to the panel. We have put up our first Fulbright website. It's on the Global U page, thanks to Howard and the work that he's done. We now have an application page, we have a background page, but that's just the beginning. We're looking to you to tell us the kinds of supports and resources that are needed to make Fulbright much more of a reality on this campus and facilitate the opportunity for students, of which I see many, many here today, and for our faculty to apply. And knowing that the university values this, not just because of global rankings, but because of the incredible opportunity that it affords you. So I don't want to talk any further, since this is all about the panel, and we're short on time, and it's all about you. So I do just want to say thanks once again to each of the panelists for being here today, to Professor Mellon, to Howard, to the Hinckley Institute, and this will be the first of what we hope will be many such forums now and into the future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hartman, for your heartwarming comments about Fulbright. We'll be happy to share with you some of my experience, maybe some other time. At Washington State, we have started what we call a WSU Fulbright Academy. And the role of that academy is to provide a platform for all whole community of the university and even in town to participate in different things. For example, these panelists, I'm not sure what kind of opportunities they have had to bring their experiences, whatever they have learned and the activities they had. So our academy provides that monthly seminar series where we have folks who are coming back or visiting campus to give us their ideas how their experiences could be utilized. And many of our visiting folks may have some ideas they want to share in the classroom. So I'll be more than happy to discuss with you how it could be done here at University of Utah. Those of you who may be relatively new to Fulbright, I'll just like to take a minute or two to just to share with you what does it mean by Fulbright. This was all about Senator William Fulbright, who was elected from the state of Arkansas right after World War II. And he went to the Senate as a young senator, and he said, you know, I'm very disheartened and depressed with all this killings that we are doing in our world wars. Is there any other way that we can negotiate, we can talk rather than we fight? So he proposed this idea to create a forum where other nations can talk to the United States and we can talk with them. So everybody looked around and said, you know, are you asking for some money? We don't have anything to give it to you. He said, don't you worry about it. I have figured it out. How about if you allow me to sell all the arms and ammunition which are left over from World War II? And everybody looked around and said, you know, it makes sense. Okay, go ahead and do that. So with the help of, obviously, United States government, they formed this forum, a scholarship exchange program, and then 1946, United States government declared as a Fulbright exchange program. So from there, it has grown to the point, now this is the largest scholar exchange program in the world. We send close to about 800 faculty scholars or professionals to about 120 countries in the world, and we receive about the same number, a little even more than that, to receive in the United States. The old mission of Fulbright. Now, that does not include the students. We have also student programs which are under the same umbrella. So Fulbright has become a very large program, which is an umbrella program. We have opportunities for administrators who can go for 2 to 6 weeks. We have Fulbright core scholar program with faculty and professionals can go out from as little as 2 to 3 months, as long as 1 year, and spend in another country. And then we have short-term program, what they call Fulbright Specialist Program, that you can go from 2 to 6 weeks and work on very focused project. A faculty may have a proposal to revive some theories or have a curriculum revisions or some other things, so you can become Fulbright specialist in that way. Please keep in mind, this is almost any U.S. citizen can apply to Fulbright in one fashion or the other. You can be a private attorney or a private practitioner of some kind. You could be an artist. If you have an idea, if you want to make difference, you are welcome to apply. So it is a very large website. You just go up Fulbright.org and you will find all kind of opportunities. While we are talking about Fulbright, what it has done good to human being or to this world. At this time, we have about close to 300,000 Fulbright alumni all over the world, and only about 120,000 in the United States, rest of them are in other countries. And we are reaching out to try to, you know, utilize our contacts as a country to take advantage of that. So what other things I can tell you? I looked in, on our website yesterday. So far, since 1946, there have been 44 Nobel laureates who were Fulbright scholars at one time. 44. There have been one person you may know, it has been pretty famous here, is Dr. Henry Kissinger, who went to India in 1962-1963 as a Fulbright scholar. Then in 1973, he received a Peace Nobel Prize. So there are 43 more like him. Then there have been 28 head of the states in many, many countries, prime ministers, presidents. So there's a lot of contribution, a lot of things to talk about this program. So I encourage all of you to please look at this program and see how you can contribute. Again, the idea is, the mission of the Fulbright is to create understanding between people of the United States and people of other countries. Simple as that. It has no influence of anything else, no politics, no religion, nothing. We are just base of humanity. We go out and talk to people and let them see who we are and then learn from them. And this is what we are trying to do today here. And I'm just so thankful to our panelists that they are here joining me. So, as you know, we have all Fulbrighters a wonderful experience, and you will hear more and more, well, this experience has changed my life. Almost every Fulbrighter will tell you that. But here, I am going to request our panelists to focus on three questions, and they are going to answer each question taking about 2 minutes. So we shall see how far we can go with it, right? So the first question is, which I think most of us want to hear, is that, how did you prepare? How did you find out about the Fulbright? Was there something unique about that that you applied for it? Should we start with Dr. Bruce Smith there? Please. You're welcome to use the
Well, we all have very busy, full lives, and so that was true for me, and I had to coordinate personal circumstances and professional circumstances. I came here in 2002 as department chair in communication sciences and disorders, so I wasn't in a position at that time to take off and leave the department. I had just come to chair. So in my previous university, I was at Northwestern University in Chicago. We didn't have any sabbaticals or anything, so it took a while to get to the point that I could actually earn a sabbatical. So after I'd been chair for 7 years, I told the dean I was finished as being chair, and at the same time I had some family and personal matters I had to kind of coordinate, and then I applied for the Fulbright, trying to kind of time everything so I could have a sabbatical in conjunction with that. I thought back, and I'm not really sure how or where or when I learned about the Fulbright program. I guess it was something I just heard about over the years, but I couldn't pinpoint a time that I first heard about it. And so I went to the website like 2 or 3 years before it was time to apply and kind of started getting information and trying to understand things. I came and actually talked to Professor Lehmann, I think a couple of years before I applied, to get some advice and information and just tried to find out sort of how the program operated and how to craft a meaningful, hopefully fundable application. And sort of what prompted me to one extent to want to go to Poland was that I had lived in Germany back when there were two Germanys, and I'd been to the border between East and West Germany and seen the guard towers and the signs about the landmines, and I'd seen the guard dogs and all the different kinds of things that were meant to keep Westerners out of East, I guess was how they framed it. And so when the Berlin Wall and all the things that happened back in 1989 occurred, I was completely amazed because I didn't ever think that I would see that in my lifetime. And so I wanted to have a chance to go back to Germany and to that part of the sort of Eastern Europe to see how things were and how they had changed, and talk to people about, you know, what had happened in their lives. And I got a chance to talk to lots of different people in Poland about pros and cons of democratic society versus the communist kind of rule they had had. And I'm not sure if this is the appropriate question to answer this time, but I found out some fascinating things from people about their perspectives on life before and after 1989. But in terms of other preparation, there were lots of things when time got closer. Medical things had to be taken care of, physical shots, work visas, a lot of things that had to kind of all come together pretty fast to be able to take off and go for a period of time.
So. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Go ahead, David, please.
Well, my name is David Proffitt. I went as a student researcher in 2011, 2012, and I went to India. And the preparation that I did, I was finishing a master's degree at the time at Arizona State. And they have a pretty extensive program to help prepare. So it started about this time of year for the following year. So it took almost a full year to go through the whole process, which is a lot when you end up looking at, you know, the 4 pages you end up filing. but for me, I'll just go through the steps that I thought about and kind of did. So for me, I decided what I wanted to do. You know, you propose a project as a student researcher and as a faculty researcher also. And so I thought about that project, talked to, you know, some faculty and professors, and then at that point kind of decided where I wanted to go. And that language requirements come in there. I'm an urban planner, and so I was looking at the urban heat island, which meant a certain climate for me. So I was looking around the world at places where that climate would fit and talked to my wife and where she wanted to go and wouldn't go, which ruled out a few places. And so I kind of narrowed it down by process of elimination, and then talked to faculty again, people who'd been, you know, basically I was going to go to East Africa or India, and talked to people at the university, and then sought out people to collaborate with, which you have to do as a student researcher, sort of like an advisor on the project. And so that was ultimately the deciding factor, because I identified some universities in Dar es Salaam and tried to find some people who I could work with, and emailed some, and I never heard anything back. So India it was. And then decided all that and went through the whole process, got some great answers to questions. We've been talking about the Fulbright website, which has a lot of information. Sometimes it seems to be a bit conflicting, especially when you're looking at the application process. It's hard to tell sometimes what the priority is. And so ended up just talking with even more people, people who'd gone through the process, people who had seen the judging process or the selection process in the committees, which was... A lot of those people were able to offer some really good insight as far as how to craft the way you say things, what you say, you know, just even the structure of some of the essays and things like that. So Ended up going through the whole process. Didn't find out until April, I think, that late April, that I was leaving to go to another country for almost a year. And then started a lot of the more practical things like shots and what's renting my house and all the fun stuff like that. So it was it is quite involved, I would say if you're thinking about a start as soon as possible.
Thank you.
I'm Wesley Sasaki Wimra, and actually I've been on two Fulbrights. The first one was for dissertation research. And unlike my colleagues in the history department, people who study foreign countries have to go to those countries if you're going to understand anything about them. And so when I was a graduate student and applying for dissertation research funding, there's really only a couple of major funding agencies to go to. One of them is Fulbright, and you can apply for either a regular Fulbright or a Fulbright Hayes for Japan studies, and then the Japan Foundation. Because I knew I had to go overseas to do research then, while I was in grad school, Fulbright was something which everybody knew about and we talked about, and you would talk with your advisor about in preparation to go. The one thing that is emphasized a lot when you're doing dissertation research is you need to have an institutional partner. So that's not an easy process. You work with your advisor to find the appropriate institution to go study at and to find someone who will sponsor you, a faculty person. And so you need to establish those relationships very early on. In the case of Japan, they have an affiliated agency called JUSEC, or the Japan-U.S. Educational Commission, and they handle the Japan side of things. And so actually you're being evaluated twice. You're being evaluated in the United States. You're also being evaluated in Japan. And so you need a fair amount of thinking about your topic so that you can address two audiences. The process is quite long, and you need to think things through very thoroughly, and you need to know what your project is and how you articulate that project. But one of the great advantages of Fulbright is that once you, if you're lucky enough to get one, once you go, they are very good at taking care of you. They give you all the information that you need to know. You just have to make sure to do it. And once I got to Japan, the Japanese funding agency was very, very helpful. They took care of everything. There's stipend for living allowance. There's stipend for dependents allowance. There's stipend for children's education if you have children, so on and so forth. And they help you get your bank account. They help you find places to live, although they're not a real estate agency, and make sure that all your paperwork meets the conditions for that particular country. It's a great experience, and in the case of Japan, they also have, of course, a Fulbright group over there, and so they have activities that you engage in together with people Japanese people, in my case, who've gone to the United States. And so there's all kinds of opportunities for further exchanges. The second time's easier. In that you know what to do. But in this case, it was a different project. I had to go find out my own institutional affiliation, the person I was going to work with, and so on. It was a different project, but having been through the process, it was a lot easier.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mercedes Ward, and I'm a PhD candidate in anthropology here at the U. I'm hopefully defending this summer. And my story is a little different than everybody else's here, and I think everybody's story is different in its own right. And so I'd say don't put too much weight on anyone's story. So I think David's advice to, like, talk to a lot of people is great advice, because no two stories are really the same. So in my case, I didn't come to Fulbright and then decide what I wanted to do. I was working on, a dissertation research proposal. I knew I wanted to study in Nicaragua. I knew I wanted to work with an indigenous population, the Miskito people, who live in a very remote part of the rainforest there. And so I was looking at a variety of different funding options to fund my dissertation research. And when I came upon Fulbright, which, speaking of, in terms of institutional sort of support, this was a few years ago, and there wasn't as much, maybe. I don't know. I didn't know about it, I don't think, until I was on the Internet and Googling. And at any rate, when I found it, it seemed like a perfect fit. I beyond my research, it seemed like it was a good fit for me as a person. I don't know if the other panelists feel that way, too. But one of the things that I read, there's a lot of information you can find online about, like, how to craft your proposal and that sort of thing. And one of the things that I read somewhere, I can't recall now, that I found really helpful was, Fulbright is not just funding you to go and do your research project. They're funding, it's like an investment in you as a future world leader. And, you know, when you kind of, like, take that mindset and sort of own it, it's amazing, like, what you can, do, I guess. So the process for me actually was really long in terms of, like, preparing for the application, in the sense of all of the work that needs to go into planning a dissertation research project. Putting the application specifically for Fulbright together, I think I started, dare I say it, like August that it was due, like that September, October, I don't know. It was so, but fortunately I had a lot of sort of, I'd done a lot of things that actually, was like the legwork in preparation. So I had been to visit the field site. And the summer before I applied, I'd spent a month there, and I'd made a lot of personal contacts, and I knew that my research was feasible and that I could carry it out. The hardest thing for me in terms of the application was the letter of affiliation, because actually I was not proposing to go and study at an institution. I was not proposing to study with a faculty member. I was proposing to go out by myself into the forest. And so I did find a letter of affiliation with an NGO, a non-governmental organization that had a history of working in that general region with that indigenous population. And that flew, that worked. I got a Fulbright. But it was the thing that I had not planned for when I was just planning my research project. So if I had applied to NSF and, gotten my funding somewhere else, then that letter of affiliation was, like, really the thing that I wouldn't have had to have done. So plan early for that now that you know you have a heads up.
Thank you.
Hey, my name is Amir, and I'm also a PhD student here at the U, but as you mentioned, I'm an international student from Russia. So I got my Fulbright scholarship from the Russian side, so it's both American and Russian, like two-way cooperation type of thing, to go to United States for a PhD program. And I don't know if it's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. In natural sciences, especially in chemistry, Fulbright is not as popular as in, let's say, political science or law or something. So there are still a lot of people, both in the United States and in Russia, a lot of chemical people who have never heard of Fulbright. The good thing is that it becomes less competitive, probably. I never tried to get a Fulbright in the law or in political science, so I don't know how different it is. So the bad thing is definitely there's a lack of information among the technical people or the chemical people. Right. So when I saw a banner type of thing in my university where I did my undergrad in Kazan in Russia, So the banner didn't say anything about Fulbright. It says just like, go study the United States. And the website, Fulbright. It was Fulbright.ru, which is Russian.
Ru, right. So,
yeah, RU is a Russian domain for same thing, but just translated to Russian. And so I just went to that website, and it, David is right. Some parts of it are contradictory, self-contradictory to each other. So the best thing, so I read through the website, and then I still had questions, and I just called the Fulbright office in Moscow, the Russian Fulbright office, and that was very helpful because they made it so much more clear and simple. You know, they just said, yes, you need to do this and this and this, and they told me about the Fulbright program and stuff. And so I also had to write some kind of an essay-ish research proposal, but I was wondering how many people could actually understand it if I'm writing it in the just pure chemistry terms, you know, like saying that I want to do this and this and this and this, but people who will be reading it, like, well, I have no idea what this is. So I wrote two proposals. One, just pure chemistry, like very scientific, and another one was more like, as you mentioned, more cultural exchange. And you're totally right. The main role of Fulbright is not only the education, but also the cultural exchange and just generally international experience exchange type of thing. So yeah, my second proposal was more like more applying to general audience, broad audience, talking about how I'm going to change the world in alternative energy using my chemical experience. And I combined them both in one file and sent it to them, and somehow it worked. So when I heard back from them, it was a second step already when you actually have to talk to people beyond the paperwork step. They asked me questions directly related to my research, so someone must read it and actually understood what I wrote there. So, but yes, it all started with, as I said, with a banner, like go study.
Wonderful,
wonderful. United States.
Just a quick comment or two, especially to Amir, that we do have review committees, and I serve on the veterinary review committee in the United States. So once you apply, it goes to those experts that are on your review committee, and from there, so many other things happen. By the way, website has been changed. In fact, just new website has been installed this year. So please have some patience with this. It's overwhelming. I recognize that. Maybe we ought to have another session where we can just walk you through, you know, to make it a little more simplified. But the program is very large, so that's what happens, I guess. So that's fine. Wonderful. Thank you very much for answering the first question. We are going to start on the second one, which is a very important one. It says, what did you learn? Some details about your experience during the Fulbright assignment.
Well, I mentioned the first time about the situation I had encountered spending time in Germany when it was a divided country, and peering across the wall into East Berlin and across the fences into other parts of East Germany. And when things opened up, wanting to kind of go behind the curtain or the former curtain and kind of see what life was like there. And so I guess by nature I'm kind of quiet and shy and withdrawn, and could have easily gone and just, you know, curled up with a book on the couch after work and so forth. But I really tried to talk to a lot of people. One of the things that was kind of emphasized on the Fulbright website and in some of the paperwork we got was that we were supposed to serve as an ambassador representing the United States, not a political ambassador, but just someone to sort of represent the United States well. And so I went out to lunch with a lot of people and, you know, just out to talk to them, went out to dinner, so on and so forth. And the question I alluded to earlier, this was probably one of the most insightful things or amazing things to me, when I asked, you know, how did your life change after 1989 when the wall came down and Eastern Europe kind of opened up and so on and so forth. And I probably talked to, I don't know, 7 or 8 people about this at length. Some who were kind of young faculty, probably in their early 30s and had been kind of, you know, teenagers or young kids when this all happened, and some who were full professors. I shared an office with 2 other full professors, and so I had talked to them. And to a person, they all said, well, in some ways, life was better under communism. That was their first response, every one of them, and I just couldn't believe it. And then they went on to elaborate that, well, we had more time because there were lots of political holidays, and there was nothing to do anyway because we didn't have any money, and you know, we got to spend more time with our families because we had all these holidays, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, they would all kind of say, but life is much better as it is now, you know. But they said we do find life to be more, you know, hectic and chaotic, and we have to work harder, we have to earn more money. Most everyone, including the full professors, had two jobs. You know, it's not unusual for an assistant professor, a young starting professor, perhaps to have some kind of additional ways to try to earn income here. I did that. I, you know, taught at a community college in the evenings occasionally, or did some consulting when I was an assistant professor. But as you get a little better salary, as you get older, that's maybe not so necessary. But these folks were full professors working two jobs, one to kind of provide meat and potatoes, and one to provide money for their own research, because they didn't get a lot of research money at their institution. So that was very insightful, one of the things I guess I learned. And then I think just in general, there was a saying, because I studied German as an undergraduate, the famous sort of poet philosopher Goethe said that he who speaks only one language sees the world through only one eye. And I kind of felt the same thing through, you know, just if you've only lived in one country, you really haven't experienced what the rest of the world is like. And so just being there, I took advantage of the opportunity to travel on weekends. I went to other parts of Poland. I went to Germany a few times, went to Belgium, France, just had a chance to kind of see other parts of the world, some of the places I'd been to previously, but some I hadn't. And so it was always fun to kind of see other cultures and how life is like in other places. So that's, I guess, what I learned a lot about.
Thank you.
Hello. So short answer for me is I learned how to drive a two-stroke motor scooter in Indian traffic, but which I'm quite proud of, by the way. But the longer answer, I think, really speaks to what you were saying about just being immersed in another place. I mean, I've even before Fulbright, I'd traveled pretty extensively, but it's, you know, as probably most of you know or can imagine, it's not the same thing as living somewhere for an extended period. And you get to know the place, you know your neighbors, you have your grocery store, learn how to ride trains in Mumbai during rush hour. It's great. And things just start to make sense after a while that, you know, initially were incredibly foreign. And then coming back, it seems strange that doesn't exist everywhere sometimes. But I mean, I learned a lot doing my research. Definitely learned a lot about how Indian government agencies work when you're requesting data, which is, there's a lot to learn there. And I think, though, maybe I'm jumping to the third question, but I think the biggest impact, at least for me personally, were just the everyday experiences, and those are the things I think that really stick with you. And that's the aspect of Fulbright I think that's nice. That's part of your job. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go other places. You're supposed to talk to people. You're supposed to explore things other than your work. You know, do that, but also do other things. And don't feel guilty about it. That's what you're supposed to do. And that was great. And I was so thankful for that, because it definitely translates into just my everyday life now. I definitely see the world differently after being in India for a year. And I think it's a better world because of it. So,
thank you.
Yeah, I think what they've said previously speaks to your experience as a Fulbrighter gives you both breadth of experience, and it gives you a lot of depth in the country that you go to, and also in the particular study that you're engaged in. And at least in the case of Japan, institutionally, it's also set up for you to meet all the other Fulbrighters, whether they were Fulbrighters that went from Japan to the United States or from the United States to Japan. And the kind of contacts then that are institutionally provided through, you know, gatherings at certain times of the year really do a lot to broaden your experience. I mean, it's just really interesting to talk to other Fulbrighters who've come to a particular place to do something totally different from what you're doing, and makes you understand that society in a very different way. And so a lot of the people that you meet through those occasions are people who you continue to, you know, have conversations with even afterwards.
Thank you.
So I'll try to just be brief. I learned a lot, of course. I mean, all Fulbrighters are immersed in another culture, and certainly I felt that very acutely being in a village where there's no internet, no cell phones. I did have a satellite phone, but it's super expensive, so very limited phone calls. And I lived with a host family also. I did not have a private apartment. And so I was really just fully immersed in just the day-to-day, you know, lived experience of people. And of course, I focused on my research project as best I could. But I like how David put it's like an excuse. Fulbright gives you an excuse to, you know, take the time to not just do this narrow research question that you're really like officially there for your dissertation work, but to take the time to really engage in other ways. And particularly for anthropologists, it's just Fulbright is the perfect fit, because our discipline actually does value this holistic understanding of other cultures. And so to get out and, you know, just take the time to go to the local parade or whatever that's going on, and it gives you a different window into that culture, right, and what people value and how they perceive their place in the world. And it also gave me an excuse when I was stuck in Managua, not my field research location, but for various bureaucratic reasons, permits and such, you get delayed. So I was stuck in Managua for a while. And knowing that I was there on a Fulbright really did encourage me to, not just stay in my room reading more research articles or something, but to get out and meet people. And I learned so much, in particular, I think, over my whole experience about poverty. What does that mean? And how it's experienced differently in a rural indigenous community versus an urban mestizo community. And, you know, that kind of sort of depth of understanding, I think I could have missed it, I think, if I had sort of maybe not given myself that extra psychological permission to just spend time talking to just random people that I might encounter who were not my research participants, right?
Thank you. So, Amir, you're going to tell us what you learned so far, what you're learning about United States.
Well, right? Yeah, I still keep learning every day. Yeah, like I just submitted my taxes recently, so quite an experience that we don't have in Russia. So basically, it's hard to add anything to what other panelists said. It's totally true that Fulbright is not only about actually learning your field, but also engaging a lot in the culture, the local culture, and understanding how the local people live. Maybe it's also jumping to the third question, as David did, it's also will help make you, I think at the end will make you a better person, because you'll see different lifestyles and different everything. So,
right.
Yeah, I'll try to be very good.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to make a comment here that Fulbright program really looks at towards you. They call you cultural ambassadors. So when you're going from United States, Fulbright is expecting all these things which you just heard. And you may be in those situations where people look at you and ask you questions just like you are responsible. You know, how come you Americans are doing this and this? So, you know, you have to really look around and make sure that you don't get involved in religion or local politics. You just stay with what the facts are. You know, so cultural ambassador is a very, very important role of the Fulbright. So as they have mentioned, when you're preparing application, don't forget that. you have to somehow, with your science, arts, political science, whatever you're trying to do, at the end you have to, you know, have your head around that whole topic and say, this is how I'm going to change the world. And that's very important, because we want to see that, reviewers, that you have thought about that, the old dream of William Fulbright. The last question, Dr. Smith, is that what impact professionally and personally the Fulbright experiences have created?
It was a wonderful experience, not without some ups and downs and some sort of minor drama. Originally, my wife was going to come with me, and then we had some family things occur that she wasn't able to come, so I was on my own for a semester, which was a challenge. I kind of called it my Walden experience. I had a little tiny apartment that was about half the size of this room, or smaller. I had to cook for myself. I lost 10 pounds. I met some wonderful people. One, I don't know if everyone is assigned a shepherd, but the place I went, they called this person a shepherd, who was kind of my connection to the department and someone who was going to help me find an apartment and, you know, find which tram to take to get to work, and just all the ins and outs of living in this this city of a million or so people. And so it was a, you know, modest kind of meager existence in some ways. I had a little television about this big, which I'm sure is bigger than the one you had. But it only had like two or three channels. I could get BBC and, you know, CNN Europe and a few things. But it was still a wonderful experience. Fortunately, we had Skype, so every night before I'd go to bed, my wife was just waking up here, and we could talk. But from a personal perspective, just getting to meet all the people I met and talk with them, not only about the things I mentioned previously, but just talk to them about their lives and talked a lot about politics. I was there when the president of Poland was killed in a plane crash, if you happen to remember that. So that was a topic we got to discuss quite a bit. I was also there when the volcano in Iceland erupted and kind of shut down air travel over Europe for a long time, which also affected me a couple of times. But in any case, that was some of the personal benefits and experiences. The shepherd I had, I'm still in contact with. We email two or three times a year, and had lunch at a conference last spring in Montreal, so on and so forth. So I've maintained contact with him professionally. It just was kind of a coincidence that there was an international conference being hosted by the department that I was in when I was at the university, and so I went to this international conference that had a lot more people from Europe attending, obviously, than typically come to conferences over here. So I got to meet a lot of European colleagues. I actually also met a person from the next building here that I didn't know, who was there as a Russian specialist, and turned out we have some common interests. We've continued to collaborate on some research here now that we've given a couple of papers and so forth, so it's had some professional benefits. A book chapter that came out of a talk I gave at the conference in Poland and so forth. So it's had a lot of personal and professional benefits for me.
Thank you, Dr. Smith.
I guess I'll tell this brief story. The last time someone asked me this question, I was in an after-hours bar in Nepal, but it was on my break from Fulbright, so that was I was not being a bad cultural ambassador. The answer I gave at that time was, I think I said something about humility, where, you know, particularly in fields like urban planning, but it's, I think, probably true across the board in academia. You know, you spend all this time learning about something, you tend to think of yourself as an expert, and then it's easy to act like one, which isn't necessarily the best thing to do. Certainly not the best thing to do in a completely different cultural context where you're an American, often. So you don't want to play into that stereotype. And learning how to still kind of do my job and do research and talk about the things that, you know, maybe I know about, certainly have things to learn about, but learning how to talk about things in a way that you don't fall into that stereotype, is sort of one level of humility, and it's the most immediate, I think, and very useful through the rest of your life. At least I hope so. And the other part is, I think, a lot what Mercedes was saying was just kind of immersing yourself and sometimes letting things go and getting into the flow or into the feeling of another place and another time. And that, the ability to do that and also the experience of having done that is, well, honest, it's a little hard to describe and explain, but I feel the effects of that really every day. So,
thank you.
I guess if I speak about impact, I mean, the impact of the Fulbright was I finished my dissertation, and so I got a job. you know, which counts for something. But I think, really, the most important thing is that you meet really interesting people, and you continue the conversations with them. The first person that I met when I went to the Fulbright office in Japan, when I went to do dissertation research, turns out to be someone who I still have constant contact with to talk about both professional and, you know, regular, ordinary cultural things. And I was just at an Asian Studies conference where the person who was on the panel next to me remembered me from when I went to do dissertation research, was someone who had gone to England for 12 years and then gone back to Japan. But you never know how the experience will loop back and affect you. So someone who is now working on a topic that was related to what I was doing. So it's extremely valuable in that way.
Thank you.
Yeah, so beyond the fact that the Fulbright allowed me to complete my dissertation research, it's hard to know. Amir and I were talking about this before the panel, that it's hard to know maybe, you know, with only a couple years out or you're still in your Fulbright, to know what the effect is of the Fulbright. It's also hard, right, to scientifically, like, actually, like, identify that it was the Fulbright that specifically caused this thing to happen. I can say that it specifically caused me to be invited, or allowed me, I shouldn't say caused, but allowed me to be invited to be a member of the Utah Fulbright Association board. So I'm a board member, and I've been working with them for the past 2 years, and that's been, you know, just a great opportunity to get more involved with the local community. So that is a specific, you know, example. But more generally, I think, like, taking the long view, the fact that I was there on the Fulbright, and like we were talking just earlier about getting to know another culture, getting to know other people and their experiences on a very sort of personal and intimate level, can really change how you view yourself in the and the world and your country and all of that. And I think for me, particularly because I'm interested in moving forward and doing work in sustainable development, the kinds of insights that I gain through that Fulbright experience are things that are, I mean, they're just invaluable. I mean, that's hugely important to not just be sort of the expert that comes into a community and say, hi, hey, I, you know, I, this will improve your community and just impose some expertise. To be able to actually feel like you've connected and that you understand, for example, the problem of water in a remote community. It's different when you've been there and you've lived there and you had to deal with where you get your water yourself for months and months. It feels different. It's personal. It's intimate. And, you know, it's not just a logical sort of rational understanding or supposedly rational understanding of the problem. So I think that's sort of more of a long-term effect.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's the same here. Mercedes is totally right. I don't know yet. This is the short answer. Ask me in 5 years or in 10 years. But yeah, definitely the international experience will make someone a better person, have a broader views, maybe less having less stereotypes, more like cultural and just general connections with people from abroad, and just generally knowing people and meeting new people, meeting new interesting people is probably the best thing you can gain from that. From Fulbright specifically, because here we have this the Fulbright chapter that Mercedes mentioned, and there we have a chance of meeting other people, like other Fulbright scholars from different majors, you know, not necessarily chemistry, but all others. And this is one of the best things I love about Fulbright, is that it's very uniting, and it stays in the community, and then you can talk to all kinds of people like from everywhere around the world, pretty much, so...
Thank you.
And also, there's one example I would like to give. I think I gave it in the Fulbright chapter meeting. It's a horrible example for Fulbright. There is a Fulbright, a world-known person who got Fulbright scholarship in chemistry to go to MIT to do his PhD in chemistry, and he rejected it. His name is Dolph Lundgren, and he is a Hollywood actor who is most famous for his shooting, fighting movies. I never knew that. Apparently, he had a Fulbright scholarship in chemistry, and he got it in MIT. And he said no. He preferred his actor career. And I don't know how it turned out to be. Was it necessarily the best decision of his life? But he's pretty much the only other chemical Fulbright I know besides myself. So I'm tempting to call him and ask, like, hey, how do you feel about this now? So.
So thank you very much. Just to expand on Ami's comments here, he's right. Early on, Fulbright was started based upon humanities, all the disciplines of political science, psychology, economics, and then slowly it has gone to the basic sciences, chemistry, physics, things like that. It has been only last about 5 to 6 years that they are going into hard sciences now. And for this special emphasis on postdoctoral fellowships, that if there's anybody who is close to finishing PhD, there's a special, special track for postdocs. So there's more and more in sciences now than even in the arts fields. So those of you who are in science fields, do not feel discouraged. And just to let you know that there is a different, twist to that. Regarding learning, one thing I like to just mention based upon my own experiences too in Oman is that you also learn about yourself, who you are, and where your place is in this world. And you look also towards United States sitting outside to see how the whole world is thinking about United States when you're turning on television and how people are interviewing, how they talk about United States. So all these things really come together to make, I think, at least in my situation, better person. And whatever Dr. Smith mentioned about his family and his wife, at least for scholars mean professionals and faculty members, if you intend to go out more than 3 months or more than 6 months, I think up to a year, you are also, your two dependents are supported. Your two dependents, in addition to yourself, Fulbright will pay your airline tickets, as well as your living allowances there, rent, depends which country you go to, because we have collaborative agreement with different countries. I mean, Fulbright has it. About almost one-third of the budget of Fulbright comes from support from other governments. And some governments do more than their share. For example, you may recall Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, came to the United States about 2-3 years ago. And him and Obama got along very well. So they created Obama-Singh Initiative. And what that means is that now India matches dollar for dollar. So out of 800 slots, 800 scholars we sent from the United States to other countries, 10% go to India. So if you end up going to India as a scholar, your even title changes. Then you are in India, you are called Fulbright/Nehru Scholar, because they're matching dollar for dollar. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing. So many governments do that. Some of the other programs we have for administrators, that they can go for about 2 to 3 weeks to 6 different countries, Germany, India, France, Korea, Japan. And the reason you go as an administrator, because they want to show you and really teach you how their education system works, so that your folks from here, Utah, can go to those countries and how you can maybe potentially recruit students from there over here. So